This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasudhi. Many countries, including Malaysia, have alluded to the importance of green economy as the way forward for development. But how committed is Malaysia in developing our nation to be green, a green economy? Well, Yasmin Rashid, the chairman of Malaysian Environmental NGOs, or what we refer to as MENGO for short, and Muhammad Shahreza Hussein, the executive director of the Malaysian Nature Society, join me to discuss the commitments needed by all Malaysians towards addressing environmental concerns in Malaysia in our quest to become a green economy. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
You know, back in 2012, Malaysia had a very ambitious plan to be a green economy. I mean, what did that national green economy framework actually reflect?
Well, I think first and foremost, these two words, green economy, is still very less understood in this country today. What constitutes green and what about the economy that can be green? I actually prefer to call it sustainable.
Fair enough. Okay, all right. Sustainable
just
economy.
Just get rid
is.
Of the word green, because green can be sometimes, overused to a large extent.
What was in that, green? Was there a policy? There was a Malaysian National Green Technology Policy. Is that what we're referring to?
We could refer to that, but I don't think there is one singular sustainable policy that we have. We may have fragments of it integrated in different ministries and different guidelines in government agencies, but in totality, I think we lack an integrated sustainable economy or guideline for the whole country that's applicable to the normal layperson and corporates and industries. And I think these three target audience, layperson, corporates or industries, are very, very critical. They're more or less the elements that could be the change makers from unsustainable practices today to something more sustainable in the future.
Funny you said that, Yasmin, because I always thought we had a green ministry. Dato' Dr. Peter Chin. Yes.
Yes, can I just add to Yasmin?
Yes.
Basically, I think the government has, at an international level, committed itself to various conventions and treaties pertaining to the environment, more so on the Rio
Summit.
Kyoto Protocol. And in Copenhagen, as everybody knows, our Prime Minister made a very bold statement of reducing our carbon intensity emission by 40% using the baseline, previous baseline. But following on to that, then the government tried to put certain policies in to make sure that the country and especially government agencies move towards that. However, good that may be, I think in terms of implementation, we seriously have to reconsider what we're doing. Number one, there are certain agencies like the Green Technology, Green Tech Corporation being set up to look into renewable energy, and then there's the Energy Commission to look at renewable energy and all those stuff. But I think it has not been taken into a very holistic measure. A lot of it has to do with industry, just like what Yasmin says. A lot in terms of individuals, in terms of public, households are not taken into consideration. Mm-hmm. And more so, when you look into sustainable development, it's just not the green that we have. It's just not brown issues such as climate change and recycling and reduction of carbon footprint that we have to look into. But we also have to look at the other side of the balance, which is the natural ecosystem, which contributes a large part of balancing what green sustainable development is all about. Mm-hmm. You can't just concentrate on one and put less emphasis on both.
Right. So, I mean, on a wider scale, where do you see us in terms of a sustainable economy as compared to, in the region, for an example? I mean, are we moving in the right direction at all?
I think we're moving in circles. When will we hit the right direction? I'm not sure. I hope soon. Mm-hmm. It seemed like with so much focus in this country on green technology and so forth, my personal opinion, I don't see much impact on the ground when it comes to the public. I think currently the approach is very top to bottom heavy. I totally believe it should be from bottom up, mm-hmm. amass the public, have better enforcement on the ground so that people are mobilized on the ground, and that can naturally produce more measurable impacts. I mean, coming up with policies is good. We need policies. But if you'd like that part where enforcement comes in, then it's almost as if the policy is just sitting there for just, you know, to fulfill its particular reason.
Very much a diplomacy talk, actually.
Yeah.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
No one's really walking the talk.
Yeah. Also, from corporate perspective, some corporates do take what they term as sustainable measures in their office. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, basically greenwashing, you know, or looking for tax breaks or getting grants or things like that. It's not really internalized and embedded into corporate. What Yasmin says is really, really pertinent, because what makes companies and corporates is individuals. You know, if you move individuals into understanding the importance, then you will move them when they are in their office, in their business, in their corporate, because that is genuinely coming in from the individuals who are committed themselves and would like to commit their companies into sustainable development. Mm-hmm. If you just put it as policies and top-down approach, you know, then people will put token effort into actual sustainable development.
Right. So what you're saying is, until the individual is educated and is aware of his or her importance when it comes to contribution towards a sustainable economy, it's going to take us a long time. And what all of this has to start in school, don't you think?
School also, just looking at, I mean, now we know we have policies. Now we know somewhat what is right and what is wrong, what is allowed. I'm sure there is a limit to how much you can emit in a particular industry. I think the second thing that I would like to stress on is, how serious are we on following through these policies? And I'm specifically mentioning about enforcement. I think that is one thing. If you cannot get enough people to mobilize and make a difference for a better environment, for instance, then we need to somehow have some kind of stricter penalty or law for people who are violating it. I think that's one area which, I mean, we can have really nice policies. You're not supposed to take this from the forest. You're not supposed to sell this animal because it's endangered. But then we just give a little small slap on the wrist and let them go. Mm-hmm. So if you're really serious about it, really now, I mean, I think this is long overdue, we really should look at how we can criminalize some actions that will jeopardize green or sustainability in this country.
Right. You know, Yasmin, Mango had certain requests from policymakers sometime in February. The M&S also had certain requests. We'll come to that in a short while. But what was on your wish list?
For this,
to policymakers in February, I understand you had a press release. You know, you had your wish list in place.
I wish we would really, really look at how we can really get some basic data. I mean, we know how much the country makes in terms of GDP, but we don't know what the value is to our country. And I think the key thing that I want to focus here is, how do we mainstream sustainable development to the public and to more industry and corporate players in this country? By mainstreaming it, that means we're making sure that any element about sustainability, sustainable development, is embedded or ingrained in any operations, whether in school or in your factory or in your businesses and so forth. I think that is one critical indicator. And Show them how to measure it and how we can, you know, come up with results that can counter the adverse effects of our impacts. I mean, the basic thing is, when we wake up in the morning, you know, when I go to schools and talk to schools students, and I ask them a question, what have you done to the environment today? And most of them would say, nothing. I just came to school, I'm here, I'm still here. And, you know, we're so detached from knowing that, you know, every time you switch on the pipe, we're already using water that's extracted from the river. And for the students, as far as they're concerned, they don't have any impact on the environment. And that's a flawed perception. So how do we make this ownership, this thing about sustainability, of such a big word, so many definitions, become a by-the-way kind of thing to the general public?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the key here. How do we drill that into everyone's brain?
Sure. What about the Malaysian Nature Society? You had certain requests as well, I mean, going forward for the next 5 years.
Yeah, in late February, we actually had the press release and press conference to actually address the power, the people in power, whether now or in the future, to actually state very clearly what is their stand and what is their agenda in terms of protecting the environment and conservation of a natural heritage over the coming years.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we are all going to cast our votes in a very short while, but has anyone taken on what you're saying?
There were individuals that influence policies and whatnot that has come forward, but not in terms of the bigger political parties, if I have to say. They have not made it very clear. And in fact, looking at the manifestos, I don't want to go into that, but it's sad to see that the environment has not taken a strong position. You know, nobody has put a strong position.
Mm-hmm. I saw it and it's rather vague.
Yes.
And nothing specific.
We must remember that when we talk about educational policies, we talk about business, finance, security issues, we must remember that in the environment is an equally, if not more, important issue to be highlighted and to be addressed. It's because without a proper environment, you know, long-term sustainability, it doesn't matter whether it's food security or finance or whatever, it'll just go down the drain. Mm-hmm. Because the environment is something that us human being needs to protect in order for us to survive. You know, all this talk about protecting planet Earth, in a way, is not really it. The planet Earth has gone through over the 4 billion years in existence all kind of climate change and other issues, but the planet is there. But what is not there is species. And we are an organic species on this planet that's facing imminent danger from our lack of looking at the environment that sustains us as human beings and other animals. Simple, just two simple example is the air we breathe and the water we drink, as Yasmin pointed out. Every morning we turn on our tap. We ask ourselves, where does that water come from? And the majority of us says, well, water tank, water pipe. But if you go down the chain from the water tank to the water pipe, to the reservoir and to the dams, then you ask yourself, where did the water from the dam comes from? Mm-hmm. It's all from our rivers and our streams.
Yep.
And where do they get their water? They get their water from the highland forest. We don't protect our forests. There's just no water. No water, you cannot live. And so the air we breathe. Just very two simple ecological systems, services that our natural heritage, our natural forest has given us. We all study in Form 2, Form 3, or even earlier, that the only thing that gives us oxygen are trees and plants. You know, and the large trees and plants are all in the deep, big forests. If we do not sustain that, then we have problems breathing. So it doesn't make sense not looking after those two critical issues and start complaining. You know, I don't even want to go into why fish is less in the ocean. We don't look after our mangroves and our corals, which are the breeding places for our fish, and we complain there's no fish, why we're destroying them, you know. So anyway, back to the Malaysian Nature Society, we did a press release and we had 10 points. It's too much to elaborate here. But the first and most critical is actually to have public consultation. Whatever the government wants to do, there are individuals, there are organizations, there are subject matter experts in areas of environment, mm-hmm. you know. And for long-term sake, you know, they are making decisions for the rakyat. They must engage people who will give them the right views and input.
Right. So are you saying, I mean, because I understand there's a lot of dialogue going on when it comes to certain development, you know, things like that. But very often, this dialogue is held very much, if you ask me, for formality sake and for, you know, showing everyone that, no, we did have that dialogue.
You're right.
And in the end, you know, these development plans...
We cautioned again over these invitations as well.
Yeah. So. And these development plans, in the end, always end up getting pushed through. So what is a way of fixing that? Do you even see a solution to that? We need to get out of this mode of wanting to make more and more money, I think.
I think we need a blueprint. I don't think we have a solid blueprint yet in this country. I mean, you've got some policies here and there tucked in, like I mentioned, tucked in different ministries, but there's no overall blueprint on what kind of direction are we heading to. And you're right, to a large extent, it's always an economic gain. And the other part is also because we have not put a value on our environmental ecosystems yet, which is something that would amount to probably more than what your business is worth if it comes to protecting this area instead of logging that area. So I think it's high time we start raising the benchmark on who are the real environmental experts in this country. And consistently, I'm talking from the government side, work with these NGOs actively instead of when they need us to come up with these kind of blueprints in the future. And I think the Mango's strength is we are a coalition. We have so many members. But up to date, as far as my position as the chairperson, I don't think collectively all of us has had the opportunity to address this with some sort of authority and so forth. I mean, I'm looking forward to a chance where we can put all our collective thoughts, not just environment. You've got to talking about social issues as well. I mean, environment is, to a large extent, people, and people from all walks of life. So your Orang Aslis, your indigenous communities, definitely need to have a bigger voice. And also trade agreements and so forth. And all these need to be more transparent to the public. A big concern I have is this upcoming Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that we may be signing soon. And if we do sign it, then all policies, green tech-related or environment-related, will not be able to withstand whatever that we will be signing off to the agreement.
When we come back, we'll find out a little bit more about this Trans-Pacific Agreement, as well as, you know, are the NGOs fragmented? How does government actually perceive most NGOs as pretty much a pain in the you know where? But we'll come back and find out more on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Good afternoon, it is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasodi. Well, going forward the next 5-10 years, we're trying to find out what will, you know, make up a sustainable economy for Malaysia. With me, Yasmin Rashid, the chairman of the Malaysian Environmental NGOs, Mango, together with Muhammad Shahriza Hussein, who is the executive director of the Malaysian Nature Society. Now, just before we left off, Yasmin, you said something about the Trans-Pacific Agreement. What is it exactly?
Okay, Mira. Can I just backtrack a little bit? I want to take, since we're on the bigger picture, I want to just say a little bit about the bigger picture in terms of consumption. Okay? You mentioned consumption, how we're consuming things and whatnot. I think one of the major things that our policy makers and those people in power should look at is balancing between consumption and development, because a lot of the environmental issues is due to overconsumption. Okay, and why does overconsumption comes about? You know, you and I know that we consume things that we don't need, you know, and a lot of the times a lot of people buy things just because
In excess, it's
there, but we have to reevaluate our consumption. And one of the reasons why we are consuming so much is because things are produced so cheap. You know, phones are such that our younger generation will change it every 6 months, whereas it could be used for 3 years or 5 years. And the reason why products are so cheap in the market is because it is catered to be produced for mass consumption. And when it's catered to be produced for mass consumption, it goes into where to produce it cheapest. And that goes, and they will go to places like China or Malaysia or whatever. Okay, the reason why they come to do production here is because they got it cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why they got cheap is because besides the labor, which is no longer cheap, you know, everywhere, even in China, is because the cost of production does not take into account a lot of other costs, especially environmental costs, your disposing of your waste and whatnot. They couldn't do that back in their country because in their country it's so stringent, it's so expensive. They have to cost it into their products, and the products become so costly they cannot go into the mass consumption. For mass consumption. So we have to evaluate, do we want to bring in this kind of production and industry into the country so that it can be produced at a cheaper cost and it goes for mass consumption. Mass consumption depletes natural resources and things like that. So at the end of the day, we need to educate people in terms of how they consume and why they consume things. Once you get that down to people, then they will realize that I don't need this so much and the demand will decrease.
Right.
Okay.
But how do you manage that? Because consumer demand is just growing, you know. I can't see it slowing down at all. So are you saying then that the solution is to take into account all of this, to have higher cost of products, and that way it will help? What about those who cannot afford it?
Then that's when we will evaluate what we really need, you know, instead of what we really want. I think the bigger picture, sorry to, no pun intended, is to actually look into our idea of progress, or our idea of
how you value progress,
you know. And Asia taking the lead now, you know, all the engine of growth is in Asia, you know. Europe is dead, America is like that, you know. The leadership should start thinking whether this is the model that we want to move forward for the planet. This is the time that Asian leaders should band together and say, no, let us reevaluate whether the current economic model is the model that we want to move forward for the world. And if they sit down and they look into the interests of the world and balance that in terms of national interest, then there are other models to be considered, you know, model that don't push into consumption, model that push business into social enterprises, for example, rather than profit maximization. So we look at developing the Asian economic view from a different perspective, and this is the time Asian leaders should, and not just go ahead and move forward on a failed model that the European and American has shown. The model has failed.
Yeah, I think that's quite old school already.
Old school.
We have to move beyond that. I mean, it's just ironic where we're trying to say we should save energy, but then we're also building multiple dams at one area. And there's so no synergy in that area in terms of, if we really want to look at energy consumption and orienting just energy efficiency, then we should really perhaps look at spending more finances or resources on looking on distribution perhaps, or even renewable energy, instead of building more just to meet the demand of the population. And water is something, you know, I many people may not like this, but personally I think the price of water should be increased.
Of course.
Because we're just wasting too much. We don't value too much. Even electricity, even trash. I believe if you don't recycle, then the recycling man or the trash man shouldn't pick up your rubbish. I truly believe that. But it all, again, leads to policy and enforcement. How will half the population feel about this? Are they ready? Are they serious enough? Because if they're not, and if, as a leader, if I know this is for the betterment of the people, I would enforce it on the ground, because right, it's about changing mindsets. And if we cannot change it in this short time frame, then we need to instill it in through bigger measures. Like I said, again, penalties, stricter penalties or enforcement, higher taxes for, like now we know by having more cars, we're going to produce more carbon dioxide. That will make our carbon footprint skyrocket. Yet we've just reduced all the taxes, which means we're encouraging people to buy more cars.
Most promises for the next 5 years include that.
Yeah.
But where is the policy on public transport?
Yes. I mean, you know, I like...
Well,
I
we're
like
setting up, and well, plans are there to set up a new ministry called Urban Wellbeing, which, you know, we'll look at public transportation. But then it makes me wonder, we've got so many ministries, why do we need another one? We need to streamline everyone and, you know, get things going. Really.
And integrate themselves, right?
Exactly. You know, you earlier on mentioned, Yasmin, that there is not enough dialogue between the NGOs and, you know, government or policymakers. But how do you think this can be made possible going forward? Because I know in most countries, NGOs, as far as government is concerned, are a pain. You know, you come across as being over the top. But how do you think you can bridge that, you know, or build that bridge between policymakers and yourselves?
I think it's very issue specific. I mean, we have our strengths in certain areas when it comes to environment, and I believe they know that as well. Therefore, we are consulted sometimes on very specific things. But collectively, how do we reach it? I mean, our clearly it would be to have more dialogues. And maybe if we can initiate it and they would take the opportunity to participate, that would be a dream come true, really. Most of the time, it would be an invitation from them. And as if we don't make it, then we will be missing the boat. But we hope we can actually strengthen ourselves and organize themselves to get them to participate in our dialogues and to take it with a pinch of salt as well. A dialogue is a dialogue. Right. We don't really want to put fingers and start blaming people, because I think this new wave of NGOs managed by younger people are more interested in the kind of conversations and the kind of outcomes that will be derived from these conversations. And I think at this point, you know, we're living in the 21st century, 21st century. We have to put all these barriers down. If we want to solve a particular issue, we got to come together and do it, irregardless of your background and where you're from. And I think that's one area which most of us are working towards. We hope the leaders will also break their barrier and come down to to the same level as us, because, you know, let's face it, we got to be friends first. We can't do this if you're enemies.
Sure, and that seems to be the case most of the time. NGOs, are you fragmented? Do you find that everyone's championing their own cause as opposed to being on the same page?
I think...
Which is the impression I seem to get as well.
Yes, I think that has been... traditionally somewhat the perception, and probably it's true, because you know, you NGOs are usually passionate about the things they do, and a lot of the NGOs earlier are very personality driven. So you've got very strong people having very strong views, but I think as the generation progress, you find that the NGOs less personality driven and more cause driven, and we come to consensus on most matters and look at it as a group, you know. And I think the movement for NGOs, at the end of the day, back to your question, how do you get this dialogue be more meaningful and taken more seriously and things like that, it would be the individual members in those NGOs that understand the issues and broadcast it out to the other members of society. At the end of the day, it has to be the public that puts the pressure. The public has to put the pressure, and that is where we're moving on. I mean, the power to be, or the power that is, should really take notice of this, that at the end of the day, the public is going to put more pressure that you cannot ignore them. If you ignore them, it's to your peril. You know, then they will ignore you and you might not be in power.
Right.
Okay, so that public pressure through the NGOs is something that will ultimately force, if you, for lack of a better word, for them to engage.
Mm.
Take for example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that you mentioned earlier. There's a lot of bones on that TPPA. But I think the major concern that all the NGOs, and this is just not environmental NGOs, you know, you're talking about health NGOs, you're talking about human rights NGOs, you're talking about IP,
HIV,
you know, a whole
gamut
of NGOs. The main concern about the TPPA is the lack of transparency or no transparency in terms of negotiation on the agreement. It is a secret document that can only be discussed within the negotiators and is cannot be made to public.
Not even after it's signed for 5 years.
Who are the negotiators?
There are 11 countries in all.
Okay.
Yeah, Malaysia is one of those countries that is part of the process of negotiating. And
Japan just recently signed.
Yeah.
Right?
But the thing is, so what the NGOs and the concerned public has to go has to rely on are some leak chapters of the agreement. And those leak chapters concern us a lot because it impacts environment, it impacts the indigenous people, the
resource.
Poor, you know. And you can spend a whole load of time. But the main issue is the lack of transparency and the secrecy of the document that is negotiated without the participation of concerned individuals or experts or organizations. But if you look at the U.S. side, who is leading the agreement.
Ah, yes.
In their negotiation, they have what they call informed advisors, you know, that are all huge corporates that have preview.
Lawyers and judges.
They have 200 lawyers working on it. They have big corporates that are advising them and have preview to their negotiation and to the documents. Even a few of the congressmen in the US that wants to look at the documents were not allowed. And the congressmen, these are US congressmen who are themselves concerned that their country is going through this without them being allowed to even have a look at it.
And we have signed on it?
If we have not. It's still going through its rounds, but it's supposed to be signed end of the year, October. Or whatever. And recently I saw a YouTube video, someone asking Tun Mahathir about TPPA specifically, you know. And he says, he's read through it, he's gone through it a little bit. Malaysia should not sign. It's dangerous for the country. You know, but of course the old man is somewhat at the side nowadays. But you know him, he's on top of world issues even though he's no longer in power. And that should be a wake-up call to our negotiators to actually re-look into what we're negotiating. Of course, the NGOs have been called, the environmental NGOs, I don't know about the other NGOs, have been called for dialogue with one of the agencies that's looking at one chapter of the TPPA. And of course, the agency says, we look after the national interest, don't worry about it, you know, we make sure Malaysia is okay. But they are only looking at one chapter and not even a holistic approach on the business chapter, the rest, you know. And we are really, really concerned about how these negotiations are going on. And it's on behalf of the rakyat for the future.
That's even more scary.
And we don't even have preview to what the draft is. You know, I mean, they can tell us all kinds of reasons why. But that's not good enough.
It affects our future.
It affects our future.
Yeah. The leaked documents, what were you concerned about?
We were concerned about how it was pro-investor. Can I give an example?
Yeah.
For instance, like if say, a foreign company comes and decides to buy a piece of land somewhere in some rainforest for a factory, without knowing what is in the land. And say in the process of building a factory in that land, and they realize that it belongs to, it's an ancestral land to an indigenous community. And in the process, if this indigenous community are suffering or complain to relevant authorities that they need to be compensated or they need to relook at why this factory is here, if we sign the TPPA, it will be pro-investor, meaning if, say, the indigenous communities protest and they would have to shut down their operations, they, the investor, would have the right to sue the Malaysian government because of a loss in business. So you're talking about, say our rare earth industry over there, if we sign this, we are not allowed to have any voice anymore if you're worried about what's being dumped in the river and so forth.
A simple example, if they set a factory now, 3 years down the road, they breach our environmental law, and we sue them, and they say they have a 20-year concession, then they can sue the government for the loss of the 17
revenue.
Years.
Okay.
Even though they have actually been closed down because they broke our law, but they have a right, you know, and various others, you know.
It's already happened in Peru. It's already happened in a few countries.
In Thailand.
Because of the TPPA.
Trade-related agreement that mirrors the TPPA.
Okay, very interesting. I mean, we can go on. I mean, I'd love to have you both on even much, much longer. I mean, there's so many concerns. But, you know, just going forward in the next 5 years, a lot of us are going to, you know, we can make a difference towards the environment from now. What would be your message in relation to the environment and, you know, what we refer to as environmental justice?
To the public or to...
To the public.
To the public. I don't know. I mean, I'm really for tougher penalties. I'm really for whipping people for not doing the right thing. I think at this point... as much as that's probably less desirable, but we're at this junction now. If we don't really enforce anything serious on the ground, nothing will happen. I mean, it's almost silly to be slapping fines which we are already doing, but we're not actually focusing on the other areas that are critical to make sure that the country can develop, obviously, but develop sustainably along with other lines. So on my personal note, it's definitely about how do we transfer this ownership of taking care of the environment to every single person on the street, and not just because of a policymaker or not just because of a law and so forth. I think that is critical now. I don't have any definite answers for that apart from just stricter penalties on laws at this moment, but I seriously think everyone from the industry to the teachers to the general, even people like us, should be walking the talk now. And we cannot wait anymore already.
Right. Riza, on behalf of MNS, your
hopes. I would take the definition of justice slightly bigger. Let's do justice to the future generation. Let us start with ourselves. Because the environment with especially our natural resources and natural heritage provide such critical ecological services for us humans to survive. And if we are greedy and just think about ourselves and maximizing today for ourselves, and we are not doing justice for our future generation. And let's be just. Our forefathers left us something for us to carry on, and we have to leave something for the future to go on. We are more educated, we are more aware, we understand issues better. We should relook at our values and see what is actually more important, you know. And I see young people moving into different set of values, but unfortunately, some of this new set of values does not incorporate environment and conservation into it, you know. But given the right incentive and the right knowledge, you know, they would switch to it, because a lot of young people go do social enterprise, do public good, volunteers, you know. But maybe they have not seen what environment and conservation is, how it relates to themselves, and they haven't taken it up, you know. Should they see that, then they realize that, you know, let's start with ourselves, you know, and try to learn a little bit more, and then do what we can. And then back to consumption, let's reevaluate our values in terms of consumption, and then we move it from there. I mean, talking about government and agencies, there's a whole load of justice there, you know. Somebody caught with 20 tiger
body parts,
you know, get 50,000 ringgit fine. What's that? That's another set of justice I don't want to go right now. Yeah.
But as you said, once the awareness sinks in as an individual, then I think things will move forward. Because once that consciousness, you know, is there, then we would also push for some kind of change and development. Thank you both very much for sharing your thoughts with me. Yasmin Rashid, chairman of the Malaysian environmental NGO Mango, together with Muhammad Shahreza Hussein, executive director of the Malaysian Nature Society, on a sustainable economy for Malaysia on the Bigger Picture BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.